His sketchbook sat in his lap, and he examined Flora with a frown. Her hair was unkempt, her jacket dirty, and she could only imagine the bags under her eyes. She leaned her head against the bars of Taniel's jail cell.
"They both know who I am."
He frowned as she spoke.
"Who?" "The powder mage, Noan. He put two and two together and called me out. Says he's going to kill me and take the bounty that Lindit put out on me."
"Can he?"
"Not in a fair fight."
"Right. Why didn't you just kill him when he threatened you?"
"Because I don't want to end up in here with you," Flora replied.
"So buy him off," Taniel said, as if the answer was simple.
Flora stared at Taniel, furious with him for suggesting it, and furious with herself for not just doing it in the first place.
"I will not buy off a man who has tried to kill me. It's personal now, and I don't think he would take me up on it. Apparently we have a history."
Taniel didn't ask further, so Flora didn't bother to explain. He sketched furiously, his hand moving over the page manically, and she could tell that sitting in the cell was bothering the pit out of him.
"Who else knows you're here?"
"Prime Lector."
Taniel's sketching stopped. He looked up, staring at the wall, then looked over at her.
"You saw him again?"
"Twice more. Definitely him, even though I can't sense his sorcery. The first time I tried to follow him, and he disappeared into thin air. I know where he lives, but I'm not touching a Predi's house. It's probably warded as tight as a king's palace. The second time I saw him, well, he spotted me first. Now he knows I'm here."
"That's not great," Taniel said with a frown.
Laura rubbed her eyes.
"Do we really know anything about him? Why does he want the stone? He's a scholar, isn't he? Maybe he's just studying it?"
"He's also part of the group that summoned Kresimir and caused the bleakening," Taniel warned.
"But if we have our facts right, he didn't want Kresimir to come back the second time. He helped turn Adro into a democracy."
"We can't trust him."
Taniel looked down at his sketchbook. He suddenly dropped his charcoal and ripped the page out, crumpling it and tossing it into one corner of the cell. Flora raised her eyebrows. It was the first time she'd ever seen him destroy a drawing in anger, even the terrible ones from his youth.
"I need to get out of here," he said.
Flora didn't disagree.
"I can try to break out tonight," he said, "but there's a ton of miscreants in here and a heavy guard on them. I'll probably end up killing my way out."
He didn't seem happy about this idea.
"I don't like killing decent people, and the deputies here are probably the only ones in the whole city."
Flora didn't like the idea either.
"We have to give it another week."
"You'll get killed," Taniel countered. "You can handle a rogue powder mage, but Prime is out of your league."
"I won't."
Her mind raced.
"I can change hotels and keep my head down.
Flaring tipped me off to men going mad at one of the mining sites. If I can get inside, I may be able to find the stone. By the time I find the stone, you'll be out. We can deal with Prime and then bring Olam and the boys into town to claim the stone."
"It's risky,"
Taniel said slowly. Once again, Flora didn't disagree. But she could still move around the town freely, and she could still hide from both her antagonists.
"Give me one more week," she said. "Then we deal with both of them together. And Flaring will have enough blasting oil for us to try to destroy the stone."
"Have you heard any more news from your Palo friend?"
"Not much that's useful."
"You really want to do this on your own, don't you?"
he asked with a sigh. Flora wanted to tell him that she couldn't trust him anymore. She wanted to tell him that he was no longer human, and that he was no longer the Adran patriot who had been a hero of two wars. She wanted to tell him that she did need to do this herself.
"I want to do this without you having to kill decent people," she reasoned, "and without drawing any more attention."
"Even if it gets you killed?"
"I fought worse."
"I know," Taniel said softly. "But you're my friend. I don't want you to die."
Flora almost told him her thoughts, overwhelmed by a feeling of guilt over her mistrust of him. She bit her tongue.
"I'm glad," she managed.
Taniel paced the cell.
"The Palo Nation definitely has a presence in the camp, but I can't figure out how big. According to my Palo friend, their representative is an underling to one of the big bosses. Most of the Palo have aligned with Bert, so I'm guessing it's one of his lieutenants. If I can get word without raising any suspicions, we might have ourselves some allies."
"I would suggest," Flora said, "not telling the Palo Nation about the Godstones."
"I hadn't intended on it," Taniel replied.
"Have you heard from Olam?"
"Nothing yet," Flora said. "They can't be far off." Taniel took a deep breath and fell onto the cell bed, arms outstretched. He still wore long sleeves and his right glove to hide his reddened skin. Despite his earlier claim of not needing much sleep, he looked tired, with deep crow's feet at the corners of his eyes. She wondered what was going on with Carpole. Taniel claimed he could sense her, even at a distance. She imagined that was as stressful as it was useful. Her own exhaustion and separation from her lover and partner were dragging at her. Her bruises hurt all the time. Her body was exhausted from too little rest. She had to run a light powder trance and drink a bottle of wine just to think clearly. Flora turned to Taniel, remembering her thoughts about Prime from the other day.
"You said the sorcerer's compass Carpole gave you isn't working?"
"That's right," Taniel responded.
He chuckled.
"Compass? Right. That makes sense. Well, it's behaving like I've put a magnet underneath a real compass. I know that the stone is here, but it's not pointing in any direction in particular."
"Maybe that's Prime's doing."
"How?"
"Perhaps Prime is hiding the stone on purpose, to keep anyone from finding it until he's finished with it."
Taniel stroked the two-week-old stubble growing on his chin.
"That sounds right.
So, if you find Prime again, you can follow him to the stone."
"I don't want to find Prime. I want to find the stone, then deal with him once I have you with me."
"It seems wiser," Taniel said.
Flora pushed herself away from the cell glass. She felt like a wagon stuck in a muddy rut, unable to pull out of it, even with her best effort. She had to get back to work before she went mad.
"I'm going," she told him, holding up a single finger. "1 week.
You'll be out without having to kill, and I'll have found the stone."
1 week, Taniel agreed reluctantly.
Flora left him there, ducking out of the jail and weaving into the traffic, her eyes on the rooftops for the telltale puff of smoke from a fired rifle. By deciding to do this alone, she hoped she hadn't just proclaimed her own death warrant.
Chapter 39. Walking up the stairs of the Landfall City morgue was the most painful thing that Mikkel had ever done. He rested for as long as he dared, until early in the morning on the 11th, when last night's injection of Marla had finally begun to wear off. Pulling himself out of the bed in a dark corner room of the underground morgue was almost painful enough to put him on his back. To not care if the entire Yarit household was about to die to a black hat bombing.
but he managed to make it out of the bed and even find a bit of horn gum in Emerald's laboratory before slipping out behind the backs of Emerald's assistants. Slipping, Mikkel considered as he climbed the stairs up to the street, was probably a poor word. He dragged himself along the walls, then along handrails, up every excruciating step. Emerald had been very clear that he shouldn't move if he wanted to recover quickly, that leaving the morgue too early might put him back in it as a corpse. Emerald had also made it clear that he would keep Mikkel tied to the bed if he needed to. But Mikkel didn't have time for any of that. If he didn't act, Jarrett would die, and with him, the household. It would kill Mikkel's best chance of finding Taniel's elusive informant, and it would also kill people whom Mikkel had come to think of as friends. Mikkel stopped on the second landing and bit off a piece of horn gum large enough to make his mouth go numb almost instantly. It helped with the pain without dulling his senses, but he needed another bite after just two more flights of stairs. He mentally detached himself from his body as he climbed in a vain attempt to ignore the pain. It was something he did when he wanted to get into the right mindset for a new job, when he had to become a totally different person. It involved floating mentally, a sort of forced high where he envisioned himself outside his earthly body looking in, trying to find a different perspective that would help him infiltrate the next mission. In this case, he simply attempted to meditate, and he couldn't help but consider the complexity of becoming these different people. That the man whom his Dainai's allies would call Mikkel Bravis was a different man than the Black Hats, or Taniel, would refer to by the same name. They were all still him, of course, but not. He couldn't help but think of his mother, of deceiving her for all those years into thinking he was a loyal Black Hat, when in fact he was still the Palo loyalist she'd always wanted for a son. He wondered if the guilt of that one deception was what drove him to keep climbing these stairs, even through the pain that cut past the vestiges of last night's mala and a healthy chunk of horn gum. Perhaps saving the Jarrett household, people who had taken him in, given him trust, and defended him to their own allies, would somehow absolve him of all the instances of so-called friends that he'd betrayed in the past. At some point, he realized, he would have to betray Jarrett. He would add Tennek, the household, and all of Dainai's to the long list of people who wanted to kill him. But not yet. He finally reached the top of the stairs and froze, staring at the open door of the morgue's front entrance and Emerald, who'd stopped with his foot halfway in, a loaf of bread under one arm.
"So, you're going, then?"
Mikkel couldn't find the strength to speak. He nodded.
"You look paler than me. We have an elevator we used to bring the corpses up and down. I would have let you take it."
"I didn't think you were going to let me leave," Mikkel managed, taking strength from a surge of anger. An elevator would have saved him so much pain. Emerald nodded solemnly.
"I would have advised you to stay, but if you're determined enough to climb 5 flights of stairs, I won't stop you."
He tipped his hat.
"Best of luck," he said, heading down the stairs.
Mikkel hated Emerald for the extra little skip in his step, then pushed out the door and into the streets. It took a moment for his eyes to adjust to the light and get his bearings. He would have to go directly to Jarrett's house in Chancellor's Court. It was risky, either from running into Sediel's people or because he might get caught in the blast himself. Walking on flat ground was easier than up the stairs, but Mikkel still found himself moving with frustrating slowness. Each step seemed like another mountain to climb,
and whenever he couldn't find a wall to lean on, he was forced to concentrate just to keep from falling over. The sight of a carriage rolling down the next street over nearly made him faint. He raised his hand, shaking two fingers at the driver, who pulled up and came to a stop just ahead of him.
"Heading home, sir," the driver told him. "I worked all night. No more fares for me."
"Chancellor's Court," Mikhail gasped. "Please, just one more." The driver leaned over, peering at Mikhail.
"You don't look so good."
Carriages were not very common since the invasion. Most had been used to take their owners out of the city ahead of the Dionys. Those that remained had to get licensed with the Dionys government and install a large green sign on their side declaring their license. If Mikhail didn't convince the driver, he might not see another till the Capitol building.
"I don't feel so good either."
Mikhail rummaged in his pockets and found two Dionys ration cards, as well as the card that Tenek had given him weeks ago that marked him as a member of Yared's household. He damn well hoped that the driver knew what it was.
"Look," Mikhail said, "here's these. This card says I'm employed by the state. Take me, and I'll make sure they pay you double."
The driver looked uneasy.
"Look, fella, I don't want to get involved with the Dionys. Bad luck and all. But I'm heading that direction anyway. Give me the ration cards and I'll take you to Forlorn End."
Forlorn End, if Mikhail remembered right, was just a few blocks from Chancellor's Court.
"Done."
It was all Mikhail could do to climb into the carriage and collapse on the bench, where he clutched his aching chest and tried not to swear with each jolt and rock of the carriage. His breathing was shallow, his eyelids heavy, and he wondered what he was going to say to Yared once he arrived. Convincing him to disrupt the household and evacuate the street over a blood-stained list of addresses was probably going to be harder than it sounded. He thanked the driver and climbed out at Forlorn End, before shambling as quickly as he could press himself down the street toward Chancellor's Court. He took a left down a narrow alley, intent on cutting across a handful of small streets to shave precious yards off his trip. He kept holding his breath, watching the sky, waiting for the blast of an explosion and a tower of flame. Mikhail let himself through the garden of one of the townhouse mansions and came out into a courtyard less than a block from Yared's household. The moment he stepped out of the garden, he regretted his shortcut. His eyes caught sight of Forgula at the same instant as she saw him. She stood with several members of the Sedil household, talking in the street directly in the way of Mikhail's route. Mikhail swallowed hard, a cold sweat breaking out on the small of his back, his heart rate doubling. Forgula tapped one of her companions and pointed, her face growing cold at the sight of Mikhail. The group turned toward him immediately, walking briskly.
"Stay put, spy," she called to him.
Mikhail began to walk briskly in the opposite direction, hoping that the effort didn't knock him off his feet, and backtracked toward the next street over. He needed to get somewhere with witnesses. No, with Yared witnesses. He didn't know if Forgula had guessed that he had searched her home, or if she just wanted him out of the way, but he knew that if she caught him before he could reach her friendly Dionys, he would be dead within minutes. He risked a jog, looking over his shoulder to see Forgula and her cronies do the same. He felt stitches tear in his chest and a shot of pain that blinded him for several moments. He nearly tripped and fell, stumbling into the mouth of an alley. A handful of children playing in the mud caught his eye. He recognized two of them, definitely members of Yared's household, and he fumbled in his pocket for a nub of pencil and a paper. He scribbled three words, then signed his name.
"Yo," he called to one of the girls in Dionys. "Take this to Yared immediately. Run, and don't look back."
The girl looked at Mikhail with some confusion before her eyes flicked to Forgula's group coming on behind him. She gave a quick nod
took the paper, and dashed off toward the Yarrat household. Pagula shouted after her, but the girl kept running. Mikhail leaned against the corner of a building and wondered if this was the best he could do. Pagula would be on him in moments. He reached toward his pockets for his knuckle dusters, only to realize that both hands were soaked in blood, as was his shirt and his pants. He was bleeding so heavily that Pagula wouldn't need to kill him. He gave a soft laugh at how close he'd come to reaching Yarrat and resumed his walk. Behind him, he could hear the footsteps of Pagula and her people, which had slowed. They must have noticed his condition, realized that they could take their time. Mikhail forced himself to raise his head, looking around for some kind of salvation as he reached the next street corner and sought an ally. No one caught his eye. He half-bent, putting his hands on his knees, trying to choke back tears of pain. At some point in his journey, he'd lost the rest of his horn gun. "Shit," he muttered to himself and turned to face Pagula. He was surprised to find that Fogula's group had stopped less than 10 feet from him, and it took him a moment to realize why. A carriage was parked on the side of the street. It was drawn by 2 brilliant black horses and had the black and red curtains of a Dionysian diplomat. A familiar face was leaning out the window, watching Mikhail and Pagula. It was Sheen Ictracia, the privileged who'd laughed when Mikhail punched Pagula. Ictracia appraised Mikhail with a single glance, then turned to Pagula. "You have murder in your eyes, my dear," she said. Fogula's nostrils flared. There was an uncertainty to her stance that seemed at contrast with being waylaid by the granddaughter of her master. "There's a snake in our midst," Pagula replied. "I was about to crush it." "Oh, come now, is that necessary? It looks like a stiff breeze would knock him over." "Then it's a mercy killing," Pagula said. Her blackjack slid from her sleeve to her hand, and she took a step toward Mikhail. Ictracia tuttered loudly, stopping Pagula mid-stride. "Mikhail, my little mongrel foxhead, what are you doing on this street? And in your condition? You should be smart enough to stay on the next street over." Mikhail looked down at the blood now dripping openly from the hand he held over his chest. He used the last of his strength to force a smile onto his face, giving a small bow and grasping for the first thing that came to mind.
"I was looking for you, Mom."
"Oh? Whatever for?"
"To ask you to dinner."
Mikhail had just long enough to see the look of fascinated horror on Fogula's face before he teetered and collapsed, face down, onto the cobbles beneath Ictracia's carriage.
"This is the third time this week I've passed out," Mikhail breathed.
He lay in a pile on the floor of a carriage, looking up at Ictracia as she stared dispassionately out the window. One of her footmen crouched beside him, holding his jacket tightly against Mikhail's chest.
"It's really unpleasant."
Ictracia remained silent, her eyes on something in the street, a troubled look on her face. Mikhail tried to read something from her posture and expression. Why she had saved him, what her plans were, if she were going to help him, but came up with nothing. He couldn't focus through the pain coming from his wound, nor the great loss of blood. Instead, he found himself considering her striking features. A man could do worse than stare at her face as he died. The carriage was moving, but Mikhail had no way of knowing in what direction.
"Thank you," he said.
"Hmm?"
Ictracia looked down at him, her eyes cold, her thoughts obviously far away.
"Oh, that,"
she snorted a laugh. "Having the chance to annoy Pagula is thanks enough." Mikkel thought of the laugh when he'd punched Fogula back at the war game. Was there some kind of old rivalry between the two? Past hatreds? Shouldn't they be on the same side?
I'd have to go to Yaret's household, he said.
Ictresia ignored him. Takulu, will he survive long enough to reach the house?
He's still talking, Mum, the footman replied. I think that's a good sign.
Sheen, Mikkel said, trying to inject some force.
I have to get to Yaret's household, please. I have to warn them.
Ictresia's attention snapped toward him with a startling suddenness.
About what? The bomb?
Mikkel's throat went dry. Ictresia knew. She knew because she was Kar Sediel's granddaughter, and Kar Sediel had arranged the assassination. He just stepped out of one fire and into a much, much hotter one.
Oh, don't look at me like that, Ictresia said. I didn't put the damn thing there. You've been unconscious for about a half hour. 15 minutes ago, a bomb exploded, destroying Yaret's house. We heard the explosion, and word just reached us by courier.
Mikkel stared at her, trying to come up with a reply. Maybe she wasn't involved, but had he been too late? Had that girl gotten his note to Yaret in time?
We have to go help,
he whispered.
Do we?
Yaret isn't a friend of mine, and I've been given no orders to return and aid them. Mikkel had no strength to feel grief, or outrage, or anything but the pain coming from his chest. He sagged, doing everything he could to keep his eyes open as the carriage finally came to a stop. The door opened, and at Ictresia's order he was carried, none too gently, down the drive of a small estate and in through the front door. A candelabra was swept unceremoniously off a large dining room table, and Mikkel was laid down in the middle, with Ictresia standing over him like she was about to quarter a deer.
Fetch me my tools, she told a footman before looking at Mikkel. I'm going to do what I can for you, she said. You've lost a lot of blood, but it looks like you've already been patched up once. If we can keep you conscious, you should make a full recovery.
Oh, are you healing privileged?
I am not.
Ictresia took a satchel from one of the footmen, set it next to Mikkel's head, and began to lay out tools.
My great-grandfather was a privileged, she explained. He pioneered a combination of sorcery and surgery that greatly increases a patient's chances of surviving. It's not nearly as effective and much more painful than healing sorcery, but it works.
She pulled on her privileged gloves, the sight of which caused Mikkel to involuntarily attempt to get up and run. One of Ictresia's fingers twitched, and Mikkel was pressed against the table by unseen forces.
Tkulu, she said, fetch Mikkel some whiskey from the cabinet. Give him a healthy swig, then put your belt between his teeth.
Mikkel could barely keep up. Ictresia moved quickly, clinically, like Emerald, but with a more refined sense of business-like purpose.
Why are you helping me?
He asked. Ictresia looked down at him as if the answer were obvious. She put a hand on his forehead, her gloves soft to the touch, and wiped the sweat from his brow in an almost gentle manner.
I'll go to a lot of effort for a man who can make me laugh, she said softly. Besides, you asked me to dinner. I may be a privileged, but I'm not a monster. I'll never turn down a meal with an interesting person.
Any further questions were cut off by the footman pressing a bottle to Mikkel's mouth and pouring whiskey straight between his lips. He coughed, sputtered, trying to swallow as much as he could. The glass rim of the bottle was quickly replaced by the sour taste of the footman's belt being forced between his teeth. Mikkel went bug-eyed as he felt sorcery hold him so tightly he could barely breathe. Ectrasia lifted a scalpel, examined it carefully, and then went to work. What, Mikkel wondered as the cutting began, had he done to deserve this?
Chapter 40. Where are you going?
Stike looked up from packing Amric's saddlebags and saw Ibana watching him from a few paces away, hands on her hips, eyes narrowed. He checked to make sure a bottle of whiskey was safely wrapped in the rearmost saddlebag, then tightened the lashings to his bedroll.
I've got an errand to run, he said.
Ibana came around Amric to stand beside him, looking concerned. For 3 days they had followed in the shadow of the Third Army, drilling in the mornings and evenings and tending to the wounded. They planned on heading back out on their own, first thing in the morning.
What's this errand?
Stike hesitated.
It's personal.
It can't wait.
No. I'm just going a few miles. I'll be back before you're ready to ride out in the
morning. Ibana didn't seem to buy it. You're not doing something stupid, are you? You have more people to kill?
Nope, nothing like that.
She gazed at him suspiciously.
I swear,
he added. Those dragon men are still out there. Our scouts saw them the other day. If you go off on your own, they're going to kill you.
That, Stike said, is why Selene and Carpole are staying with you.
Neither of them will stand for it. Pete, I won't stand for it. What are you up to, Ben? Why can't you tell me? Stike finished checking the saddle, then ran his hand along Amrek's flank, up his neck and over his nose. Amric nuzzled him gently.
Like I said, it's personal.
Take an escort, at least.
Not a chance. Personal means not having 50 men with me. Besides, I'm more likely to lose those blasted dragon men with just me and Amric.
He turned and fixed Ibana with a steady stare, waiting for her to continue the argument. He wasn't much for arguments, and was satisfied to let her win most of them. But this was important.
If Carpole tries to follow me, you truss her up and throw her over the back of a horse.
Do it yourself, Ibana snorted. I'm not touching a blood sorcerer.
Coward.
Fool. They stared at each other for a moment, then Stike pulled himself up into the saddle.
See you tomorrow morning.
He rode northwest across the Third Army camp and headed through their pickets on the far side, where it was less likely that anyone trailing the army would see him leave. About a mile out, he found a small river and rode down into the water, where he turned Amric south.
This is going to be real uncomfortable for you for the next couple of miles, he told Amric, but you'll get carrots and sugar cubes when we make camp.
They stayed in the river for 4 hours, taking it slowly so that Amric didn't slip. Stike hummed while his eyes scanned the riverbanks for Dainai's scouts or dragon men. He picked out familiar landmarks, dusting off hazy, long-buried memories and forcing himself to dig among them. The light was just beginning to wane, the river becoming more dangerous, when Stike caught sight of a particular bend and a narrow, arrow-shaped boulder balanced on a knoll about 20 yards from the river. He directed Amric out of the bank and took him up to a nearby grove, where he used an old shirt to carefully dry Amric's hooves before leaving him tied to a branch with a feed bag over his nose. Stike stood on the bank of the river for some time, watching the bats flutter overhead in the twilight and listening to the sound of crickets. He ran his hands over his face, taking deep breaths of the humid air. He'd only ever been here 3 times in his life, but the place had a biting familiarity that threatened to bring tears to his eyes. Everything about the location was burned into his brain, from the mud of the riverbanks, to the moss on the boulder, to the sound the breeze made as it rattled the leaves of the beech trees. Taking one last deep breath, he finally turned away from the river and walked to the other side of the rock. He counted out 30 paces and found a big, white-sided beech. Bending over, he felt along the trunk until he found a set of deep grooves in the side. The letter M, carved by a boy several decades ago. Stipe began to clear around the base of the beech, pulling away vines and slashing shrubs with his knife. It only took a few minutes to find the stone, a rectangular slab of white marble about the size of a bread box. He methodically cleared around it, then off to one side, where he kindled a small fire that cast just enough light so that he could continue to work. Soon the tiny grove was cleared of underbrush, and the white marble scraped clean of 30 years of moss and grime. The edges were worn, the letters faded a little with time, but he could still make out the name Marjorie Jalind, and a set of dates. He knew what to expect, but he still let out a small gasp when he saw them, squeezing his eyes closed against unbidden tears. He sat on his haunches beside the stone. For how long, he was not sure. He did not speak, or pray, or even think. His meditation was devoid of any direction. After some time, he finally got to his feet and stoked the fire, laying out his bedroll across from the grave, and leaning up against the big beech tree with a bottle of whiskey in one hand, a bag of sugar cubes in the other, and Amrek's nose nuzzling his ear every so often as he slowly fed him the cubes. He watched the embers float on the heat above the fire, and listened to the night noises until, sometime around midnight, they grew silent. Eyes closed, head back, he drew his knife and lay it across his knee before taking a swig of whiskey. Amrek snorted. When he opened his eyes again, he was not alone. The man standing beside the grave was familiar. The sides of his head were meticulously shaved to leave a bright red mohawk that was tied back in a knot over his left ear. His face was sun-hardened, the freckles thick across the bridge of his nose, black tattoos spiraling up his neck to touch his cheeks. The dragon man did not look at Stike. He stared down at the gravestone, his brow furrowed. His duster was pulled back to show a bone axe in his belt, but he did not reach for it. In halting Palo, he asked,
"Whose grave is this?"
Stike struggled to remember the dragon man's name. He was sure he'd heard it during his encounter with a group back in Grenalia. After a few moments it came to him. "G. Orts."
"It's my mother's," Stike told him. "When did she die?"
The question was deeply personal, and Stike would normally have reacted violently to anyone asking after his mother. But somehow, here in the darkness with another killer, it seemed like a natural thing to talk about.
"When I was a boy."
He tried to remember the dates on the stone. It was too dark to see them.
33 years ago, I think. "Disease." "My father's drunken rage."
Giorz's frown deepened.
"What fueled his rage?"
"I don't remember. Something trivial, probably.
He killed my mother, and he went after my baby sister."
Giorz glanced around, as if looking for another gravestone. Not seeing one, he moved to the fire and hunkered down so that he, Stike, and the grave created a three-pointed star around the flames. He stared at Stike, eyes unblinking.
"I wish to know what happened, if you'll tell me."
The oddness of speaking so freely to a man who'd come to kill him finally caught up to Stike. He tapped a finger on the hilt of his knife.
"Why?" "Because I like to collect stories of people I meet."
"People you kill?" Sometimes. Not usually.
Shiots gazed into the flames, a brief smile touching his lips.
My mother told me stories long ago. Before this.
He tapped the bone axe hanging from his belt.
Stories are all I have left of her.
Stike looked down at the bottle of whiskey.
My mother used to sing. I don't have anything left of hers, though. My sister might, I don't know.
He paused, considering the Dragon Man's previous question.
I murdered my father before he could reach my sister. Good,
Geortz nodded, as if patricide were a perfectly normal route.
A drunken piece of shit, Stike continued, rests in a mausoleum on the old family property. It wasn't right to put me mother in there with him, so I brought her here, where she grew up.
Stike nodded into the darkness.
She was born in a cabin about 100 yards from here. Just a rotten ruin now.
Stike laughed softly to himself, remembering.
I was just a kid. Didn't even think to bring a shovel. I dug the grave with my hands.
He still had tiny scars on his fingers where the rocky soil had cut them to ribbons. He shook his head to dispel the memory, then took another swig of his whiskey. He wondered who would move first, he or the Dragon Man, and contemplated snatching up his knife. He looked at the gravestone, then at the Dragon Man.
"Are your friends sneaking up behind me?"
Stike asked. Shiort shook his head.
"We split up when we realized you were no longer with the army. I believe I'm the only one who found your trail." "You probably shouldn't have told me that."
Unless, Stike considered, he was lying.
"I do not want to be here."
The words were spoken quietly but forcefully. Stike sat up straight, watching the Dragon Man carefully. Geortz continued,
"I fought on the wrong side of the civil war. Carsediel's people murdered my emperor and broke it a peace. I did not accept their emperor, so I was disgraced. I spent years in the darkest dungeons, forgotten, until Carsediel found a use for me."
"A Sikh sent after me?"
Stike asked, genuinely curious.
"They're all disgraced."
"Carsediel is vain, wrathful, and arrogant, but he is not stupid. He would not waste 6 dragon men on you, on a single person. But in the eyes of our people, we no longer exist. He took the useless and found something for us to do. If we bring him your head, we are allowed to be people again."
There was a faraway look in Geortz's eyes, and Stike wondered if this promise of freedom made the Dragon Man reckless, or whether it made them more dangerous.
"Why are you telling me this?"
Geortz looked at the gravestone and sighed.
"Because I want you to know it's not personal. War is rarely personal." "War is always personal,"
Geortz said with an affronted expression.
"The very act of taking the life of another human being makes it so. But this time is not..."
He stopped talking, clearly frustrated.
"Perhaps I don't get across my meaning. Carsediel has our blood. Do you know what this means?"
"Vaguely."
"It means he can compel us, even across great distances. He can whisper in our ears and pry truths from our minds."
"That is, unsettling."
"It is rape,"
Geort said flatly.
"But Carsediel is not perfect. He cannot watch us all the time. And tonight, I will not fight a man on his mother's grave. I am a warrior, not a savage."
Stike wondered if this was all a ploy, if Geort said these things to get him to lower his guard. There was an earnestness in his face as he struggled to find the right words that compelled Stike to believe him. yet there was still a doubt. He remembered Kushal's willingness to hurt Selene back in Landfall, and half expected a knife to come out of the darkness and slash his throat at any minute. It did not arrive. Perhaps not all dragonmen were alike. Several minutes passed in silence. Sitting forward, Stike shook the half-empty bottle of whiskey and handed it across to Giotz. The dragon man regarded it for a moment before taking a swig. He took another, wiped his chin on his sleeve, and handed it back. He stood up, straightening his duster to cover his weapons.
"I will leave you to mourn, Ben Stike. Thank you for sharing your story with me. The next time we meet, I will attempt to kill you. I will probably succeed."
He put a notable emphasis on probably. The dragon man bowed his head toward the gravestone and strode off into the darkness, leaving Stike alone. His passage was purposefully loud, sticks crackling as he walked, as if to tell Stike that he had indeed gone. Soon the crickets returned, and Stike settled back to watch the flames. Amric nibbled at his shoulder.
"All out, boy," Stike said, showing him his empty hand, letting Amric explore it with his velvety lips.
Stike finished the bottle and lay awake, staring at the flames while he waited for Giotz's wrathful return, or for one of the other dragonmen to happen upon him. He did not remember closing his eyes, but when they opened once more, it was early in the morning. The fire was ash, his bedroll soaked with morning dew. Stike stirred from his spot and took a walk around the grove, examining the ground for sign of the dragon man hiding out nearby. He couldn't find any. He finished clearing the last of the vines and brush from the grave, and walked to the old, rotted cabin where his mother was born, casting its now crumbled walls to memory. Returning to the grave, he bent to kiss the stone and then saddled Amric. He left without looking back. The column was already assembled to leave the Third Army by the time Stike returned. Ibana watched him arrive from horseback. Selene sat on her own horse nearby. Stike ignored Ibana and went to the girl first.
"Why did you leave me?" Selene asked.
"I had to do something alone," Stike said.
"I've seen you kill before."
"It's not always about killing,"
Stike explained softly.
"I had to visit someone I love. Perhaps when this is over, I'll take you to visit her as well."
Selene seemed to sense the solemnity of his words. She gave an uncertain nod.
"Karpol is angry you left her behind. So is Ibana."
"They can both damn well deal with it."
He brushed her hair out of her face.
"I should have taken you. I'm sorry. Next time I will."
With that, he headed back to Ibana at the front of the column. He let her stare at the side of his face for several moments before letting out an irritated sigh.
"Well, we've got Dino's dragoons and a godstone to find. Let's go hunting."
Chapter 41. Mikkel stepped down from Ictrasia's carriage, holding on carefully to the door until his feet were on firm ground. He wasn't entirely certain of his body, even after 2 days of forced recovering in Ictrasia's townhouse. Everything seemed to work, despite how sketchy her sorcery and surgery combination sounded, and he was in less pain than if he had just been stitched up again by Emerald. Which didn't mean he didn't hurt. He looked up at the columned facade of the Landfall City Bank. It was an enormous building, over 60 feet tall, with foreboding gargoyles perched on the decorated eaves, all finished in black marble. Last he heard, the bank had been ransacked and abandoned during the invasion, and had sat empty ever since. Now, though, half a dozen carriages sat out front, all of them bearing the black and red curtains of the new regime. A Dionysian flag hung from the highest point of the roof, and he saw a steady stream of people coming and going. He couldn't help but wonder if Ictrasia had fixed him up only to turn him over to Carcedial to be tortured. He looked up at the driver of the carriage, one of Ictrasia's footmen.
"Ticulu," he said, "why am I here?" "I just brought you to where I was told," the footman responded.
He snapped the reins and drove off before Mikel could question him further. 2 days locked up in Ictrasia's townhouse. 2 days without any information from the outside world. It was worse than when he'd been stuck in Emerald's morgue, if only because he had no way of knowing who had survived the blast that destroyed Yaret's house, and whether he would emerge with any allies left among the Dionysians. Other than Ictrasia, that was, though Mikel couldn't consider her an ally. At best, she was an enigma. After his healing, they'd exchanged less than 10 sentences. And now, he was dumped outside the Landfall City Bank.
"Mikel!"
Mikel turned to find Tenik walking toward him from beyond one of the carriages. He couldn't help a smile, a wave of relief sweeping across him at the sight of a familiar face.
"Tenik, I'm glad to see you alive."
"Perhaps," Tenik responded in a somber tone. "Come with me."
"What do you mean, perhaps?"
Mikel asked. Tenik didn't answer, turning sharply and striding away with a purpose that was incongruous with the laid-back man Mikel had gotten to know. Mikel was surprised at the brusqueness, and he slowly followed Tenik up the steps of the old bank and through the enormous front doors. Despite Mikel's obvious discomfort, Tenik neither offered a hand nor slowed his pace. Inside the cavernous main hall was a whirl of activity. Men, women, and children seemed to fill most of the space, and a vaguely organized sort of indoor camp, with tents and partitions splitting the room into 30 or 40 smaller ones. Tenik navigated the space with ease, and Mikel had a difficult time keeping up. He paused in the center of things for a breather, only to look up and see Tenik waiting ahead, watching him with a cold stare that put Mikel on edge. They continued to the back of the great room and up 2 flights of steps to the bank manager's offices. 4 Dionysian soldiers stood watch outside, muskets shouldered.
"Watch him,"
Tenik told them before slipping inside the offices. Mikel felt their eyes turn on him instantly, and he shifted uncomfortably, wondering what he'd walked into. There was something very wrong here, and it took him far too long to figure it out. The realization hit him just as the door opened and Tenik reappeared. Everyone here thought that Mikel was responsible for Yaret's death. He felt a trickle of sweat roll down the small of his back, and the behavior of Tenik and the angry stares of the guards now made so much more sense. This bank was the household's staging point, where they'd all gathered to recover. Mikel was the man responsible for this, or so they all thought, and he had little doubt who'd spread that rumour. Tenik stood in the open doorway for a moment, his expression troubled, obviously trying to read Mikel. For his part, Mikel could do little more than sweat openly, knowing how pale and frail he looked. He knew what guilt looked like, and it wasn't all that different from a man trying to keep himself together when he's physically and emotionally empty.
"All right," Tenik said. "Come in."
Mikel stepped through the door and into the bank manager's offices, which he could tell in a single glance had been co-opted by whoever was taking over Yaret's position as the head of the household. Mikel wondered briefly how the line of succession affected the name, and if Yaret would fade into obscurity, forgotten by all but a few dusty history books. It was with some surprise that he entered a second doorway and found Yaret himself sitting behind the manager's old desk, leaning forward, fingers steepled, brow furrowed as one of his cupbearers spoke earnestly. At the sight of Mikkel, Yarit raised his hand, and the woman beside him fell silent. There were four other people in the room besides Mikkel, Tenik, and Yarit. Mikkel recognized each of them as Yarit's top lieutenants. He tried to figure out who was missing and couldn't come up with anyone. Had none of them died in the bombing? His pleasure at the news, and the sight of Yarit alive and well, was tempered by the fact that everyone in the room looked at him with the same weighing, anger-tinged way the guards outside had. He was, he realized in an instant, on trial.
Mikkel, Yarit said by way of greeting. We're all rather surprised to see you alive.
Mikkel was about to answer that the feeling was mutual, but realized how bad that would sound before the words left his mouth. Instead, he just nodded.
I have the feeling I've missed a lot.
Indeed. There are quite a lot of rumors swirling around about you right now.
Mikkel glanced at Tenik, but the cupbearer was clearly going to be of no help. He felt a spark of anger and grabbed onto it, using it to prop himself up in the face of silent accusations. He didn't know exactly what was going on, but he had a pretty good guess. He'd almost killed himself just attempting to warn them of the bombing, and here they were turned against him.
I'm going to guess that those rumors include my involvement with the bombing of your household.
Do you deny them?
Yarit asked. Mikkel glanced around at the hostile faces. He'd begun to think of these people as his colleagues, Tenik even as a friend. He didn't deserve this. He was too tired, in too much pain.
Of course I deny it.
You want an explanation for my absence last week? Here it is.
He launched into a quick summary of his adventures, starting with his search of Fugula's house, then his shooting by Hendriz, and his recovery with Emerald. He finished with his attempt to warn Yarit about the bombing and his time spent locked in Yggdrasil's townhouse. He glossed over a few key details, like Emerald's name and occupation, but kept everything fairly true to reality. Yarit and his people listened without interrupting, watching him carefully throughout the whole story. Mikkel ended with a sigh and, without being invited, took an empty chair from the corner of the room and dragged it over in front of Yarit's desk before collapsing into it.
Yggdrasil saved you from Fugula?
Yarit asked. It was not the first question Mikkel expected to be asked.
She did. I've no idea why. She's taken a liking to him.
Tenik interrupted, clearing his throat.
She has, ever since Mikkel tagged Fugula at the war games.
Yarit snorted, burying a half-smile, the closest thing to humour to enter this room since Mikkel's arrival.
Oh, telling what's in a privileged head, especially that one.
He squinted at Mikkel, then suddenly produced a piece of paper. It was hastily scrawled with the words, Evacuate Household. Bomb. Mikkel. He set it in the middle of the desk so that Mikkel could see it.
That, he said, is the only reason you're standing there right now, and not already handed over to the Bornois for questioning. Because of this note, we were able to get everyone out the townhouse in Chancellor's Court before several barrels of gunpowder were detonated in the basement. The house is destroyed. The household was saved.
There was a note of gratitude in Yarit's voice that made Mikkel's heart sing. He reined in his elation. This was still a trial, and it could still go bad. Yarit continued.
Fugula has openly accused you of being responsible for the bombings that have taken place across the city. She and several witnesses claim you were present just before the destruction of my house. From your explanation, and from this note here, and the witness of the child who brought it to me,
you were attempting to warn us.
I was.
Good. Then I think we both see what Fergula is up to. Without evidence, though, Sediel will demand that I hand you over to the Bone Eyes for questioning.
Mikhail glanced between the faces.